This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Tana Weingartner, filling in for Lucy May. It's been a busy week in Columbus and Frankfort. The Ohio Supreme Court denied a request related to the law banning transgender youth from healthcare and girls in women's sports. And it's nearly time for recreational marijuana to begin hitting store shelves. Plus, Kentucky held a primary this week, and yours truly learned a new phrase, Liberty Republicans. We'll get all caught up on how the election shook out across the Bluegrass State. Cincinnati Public Schools has an interim superintendent, and the jungle is getting some major updates. That is all on deck for the Friday News Review. To get us started, we're joined now by Laura Hancock, Columbus Bureau reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's start off with the news late yesterday from Ohio Governor Mike DeWine about this ongoing deadline issue for President Joe Biden to appear on the ballot in Ohio in November.
Ohio is running out of time to get Joe Biden, the sitting president of the United States, on the ballot this fall. Failing to do so is simply not acceptable. This is a ridiculous, this is an absurd situation.
All right, Laura, can you just briefly explain what the issue is? Like, why wouldn't Joe Biden be on the ballot?
The Democratic Party needs to notify, each political party needs to notify the Ohio Secretary of State before ballots are printed. And the law says they have to notify who their nominee is 90 days before the election. So there's enough time to print the ballots. And while the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee does fall before the 90-day period, so there will be the nominating process of Donald Trump, and then they can forward that information onto the state. The Democrats National Convention is in Chicago after the within the 90-day period. It's not before. Mm-hmm. And so they're not going to do it. They're going to miss the deadline. So how does Joe Biden get on the ballot so people can vote for him? Well, the legislature can pass a law allowing it just for this year. They've done it for Republican candidates when their convention has fallen outside the amount of time needed. They can, the Democratic Party can sue, and even Republicans are conceding that they would probably win in a lawsuit. The other thing they can do is just some leaders within the Democratic National Party can quickly just have a quick meeting and say, okay, Joe Biden will most likely, because there really isn't anybody else who's got, you know, the support at the level that Joe Biden has. So Joe Biden's going to be our nominee, and we'll just notify Ohio. So far, the Democrats want the legislature to do this because they've done it for Republicans, and the legislature is saying nothing's for free, and the Republicans have a supermajority in the Ohio legislature, and so they are basically, what the Democrats see as a poison pill. They're putting it into a bill that would bar foreign citizens, foreign nationals, from contributing to ballot issue campaigns. And what this is revenge for abortion rights and marijuana, because a Swiss billionaire donated money to organizations that donated money to support the pro side of the reproductive rights campaign. And so they want to ban that to, you know, weaken the Democrats and weaken the liberal issues. And so the Democrats are like, we are not going to support this bill. And then they're like, if you don't support the bill, you're not going to get Joe Biden on the ballot. So that's kind of the impasse. Mm-hmm. So Governor DeWine on Thursday at like 5 p.m., which is very unusual, called for a special session. And I believe this is the first time in like 20 some years that one has been called for. The legislature doesn't have to follow the governor. They have their own branch of government. They're not, you know, beholden to him. It seems like legislative leaders are open to, you know, again, holding a vote on their bill. I don't think they're going to relent and let the Democrats just get a bill without having to, you know, pay a price or sacrifice with the foreign national campaign law.
All right. Well, that sounds good. Any idea how long that could take to get all that settled?
Well, the legislature is meeting again until, I believe, June 12. So, I mean, that's quite a bit away, you know, and so they could do it. The legislature could literally do it. Like, each of them could have a session in under a half hour and do it. However, like the House and the Senate. However, they could also, you know, they could drag on. The Democrats will be no votes on all of this. And so So I don't know. There also is kind of some infighting within Republican circles, between the House and the Senate. And so that could complicate things. Although at least as of last night, they were both on the record saying the House Speaker and then the Senate President were both like, yeah, let's get this done.
Okay. All right. We're going to move on. Thank you for that. The Ohio Supreme Court had a busy week on Wednesday. The Republican-dominated court denied a request from Attorney General Dave Yost to overturn a judge's order that blocks the law banning gender-affirming treatment for minors and trans athletes in girls' sports. Laura, just sort of lay it out for us briefly. What does that mean?
The anti-trans law was supposed to go into effect last month in April. Attorneys representing two 12-year-old transgender girls, including one from the Cincinnati area, sued in Franklin County Court here in Columbus because the other girl's from Columbus, saying that this law was unconstitutional because it denies their right to get health care. The Republican judge in that case, the trial judge, said, yes, I think that this law might be unconstitutional because it's cramming too many things into one bill, and the Ohio Constitution has a single subject rule. So then Attorney General Dave Yost immediately tried to appeal it. Generally, it's temporary restraining orders, which is what the judge in Franklin County put. It wasn't anything permanent. It was a temporary ban from the state enforcing this law. That one of the things that Dave Yost is trying to argue is that this is unfair, that a little order from a county can affect kids all across the state, all sorts of people who are only tangentially related to it. Other people would say, well, this is just the nature of the court system. One state court can freeze a law for the entire state. So he's trying to get the Ohio Supreme Court to agree with him. And the Supreme Court actually disagreed with him and said, yeah, the state did not meet the level, the burden that we needed them to meet in order to say we should narrow this order so it only applies to these two girls and their families. This does still apply statewide. However, Justice Mike or Pat DeWine, he's Mike DeWine's son and he's a Republican, said that they should revisit the issue of temporary restraining orders and whether they can be applied statewide.
And was that ruling that was just handed down this week that you're talking about now?
Yeah. Okay. In Pat DeWine's, like, one of his opinions, it was a concurring opinion, agreeing that the state law, transgender kids can still get their health care. He just said this needs to be revisited, this issue. And it's interesting because we're going to see a bunch of abortion laws be challenged in court. Already some are, because we have this reproductive rights campaign. The Constitution now guarantees reproductive rights. So every single law, there's about four dozen that have been passed since the early 80s that bans abortion, is going to have to be measured against the specifications of the new constitutional amendment. And so this could... of course, Republicans don't want abortion rights to expand, right? And so this could, if they say like a temporary restraining order only applies to Hamilton County or wherever it was challenged, then that means that women in Toledo, Ohio wouldn't have access to abortion while this case was being sorted through the court system. So it's whether these temporary orders are appealable. And this is going to be a big fight. And we've already seen the legislature and the Senate weigh in and say, yeah, we don't want, we do want temporary orders to be appealable. And so so this is kind of like going to be like the next front of abortion rights, is whether one order can apply statewide if it's temporary or not.
All right. So where does that leave us now in terms of where does this case go now?
Okay, right now, if you're a transgender minor, you're still allowed to get health care, gender affirming care. And the case is going to play out in Franklin County Court. It's going to take better part of a year. We'll see if that temporary order gets extended. So it's like an indefinite order that lasts the entire duration of the case. And then depending on how the case is decided, that will depend on whether kids will get, transgender health care or not. And of course, the final order that comes out of that court can be appealed to Kingdom Come. And so whoever loses probably will.
I'm sorry, you said it can be appealed to where?
Kingdom Come.
Oh, okay. I was like trying to make that be a specific person. I'm so sorry. All right. So that is kind of a turn that I think a lot of people weren't expecting, especially in your reporting. Was interesting to hear. You know, it's about this House Bill 68, this law, but then it could have much broader implications. That's very interesting.
And also, there is a Democratic justice, Jennifer Brunner, who wrote actually her own concurring opinion slamming Pat DeWine's opinion. And she thought it was ridiculous. She thought the logic was terrible. And she thought it could, you know, undermine the entire underpinnings of Ohio's justice system. So this will definitely be the next big fight.
Yeah, and that's interesting. It was a unanimous decision. They all concur, but for different reasoning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Correct.
All right. We are going to keep our eyes on that. All right. Let's turn again. Ohio has just 2 weeks to finalize the application that the state will use to grant medical marijuana dispensaries dual use licenses that will allow them to also sell recreational marijuana. We're going to talk about how the industry is gearing up for an expected flood of retail sales in just a minute. But first, you found a really interesting study. It came from a researcher at Ohio State who analyzed citations and arrests before and after the state's new adult use recreational cannabis law took effect. All right. Explain the methodology here. Like, what was he looking at?
He was looking at all citations for Ohio State Highway Patrol, which he chose to use because that's a real statewide kind of thing. It's not regional. And he looked at the 29 days before the election to legalize recreational marijuana, 29 days between the election and when the recreational law went into effect, and then the 29 days after when the recreational law was in effect. And what he found is that you have like over 30 arrests for drug paraphernalia, marijuana paraphernalia beforehand, in the months beforehand, but it went down to like 15 in the 29 days after it was legalized. So this indicates that the Highway Patrol was following the law, and the medical marijuana or the marijuana, pipes and all the paraphernalia, that law no longer applies to adults. It still applies to minors, but it does not apply to adults. So it indicates the 15 that were, it was either citations or arrests for paraphernalia. And when I talked to the Highway Patrol, they said 11 of them were miscoded. So they've been thrown out. And then 4 of them were for people under age 21. And adult use recreational marijuana is legal for people 21 and older in Ohio.
Okay. What can we kind of conclude from the study? What's the takeaway here?
I mean, at least with the Highway Patrol, they are following the law, even if a lot of the law enforcement did not agree with the recreational law, but they are following it. Now that, you know, the will of the people is being carried out in that respect, at least under Highway Patrol. You can't extend it statewide and say like every single police department is following the law, but you know that Highway Patrol is.
Right. Okay. Very good. Just a quick reminder, everyone, this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're going to turn to recreational sales now. I know a lot of people are looking forward to this. June 7th is the big day. Why are people marking June 7th on their calendars?
June 7th is the deadline for when the state has to publish online the applications for medical marijuana licensees who are currently open. So these are stores that are currently open. They can apply to get a dual use license that would allow them to also sell to recreational customers. So we're not getting any guarantees from the state if this is going to come out sooner than that. They can have it come out sooner than that. The Ohio Division of Cannabis Control has been very like not telling us a lot, but it could theoretically come out sooner than the 7th. And also, we don't know how soon after these applications start coming in that they'll start like saying, okay, the law requires, unless you've messed up how you filled out the application, the law requires the state to okay them all. Mm-hmm. And they do not need an in-person inspection because these are already running medical marijuana dispensaries. So they went through all that inspections.
Okay.
And so it would just be a matter of going through the paperwork. And I'm not really getting, I did ask if there's going to be a team, how many people are going to review and then review the review, you know, how many people are going to be working on this. They're not really committing a ton to information, at least at this point. But it's not believed to be this like huge process. So that means that we can maybe start seeing our very first, you know, dispensaries open to adults age 21 and older, you know, mid to late June, possibly July 4, somewhere around then.
And then what, you know, when that happens, once that application is approved, all the checks are boxes are checked and everything, what are we expecting? I mean, are shops gearing up like it's Black Friday?
I mean, like everybody I talked to said that they are going to do policies to make sure that medical patients have supply, because everybody and their dog is going to be coming to these dispensaries. I mean, there's going to be the novelty factor, and then there's going to be just regular users of cannabis who are now going to have a legal place to shop. And so they're all going to come, and lines are going to be really long, and there won't be enough supply at this point in the beginning phases, because the growers need to expand their dispensary square footage, but the state hasn't passed rules yet about how they go about getting permission to expand their square footage. So right now they're just being using medical plants, and they're going to use those in the store. And so there's going to be limited supply, and prices are going to be pretty high.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and explain how the pricing is going to look.
Yeah, I mean, because Ohio's pricing is already higher than like Michigan's. It's like in the middle compared to like other states. But basically, Ohio's price during this like 3 to 6 month crunch period, it's going to be pretty expensive. And then we're going to see the market start to, you know, level out, because it takes around 3 months to grow a crop of marijuana. And then you, you know, often are curing it, making, which helps like the flavors and the terpenes and all the product, you know, all the reasons why people like marijuana come out. And so you have to cure it. And so you can't just like tomorrow grow marijuana and like, you know, 2 hours is done. This is a really long process. So luckily the, if you're for marijuana, luckily the current growers who will be supplying this industry, I mean, they're not starting from the beginning. They already know how to grow this crop. They already know what works, you know, and with their own, you know, greenhouse capabilities, what they can do, what works, what doesn't work. When we saw the medical marijuana come out, there was a lot of times where they would grow a crop and then the grower would have to throw it out completely because it just felt like the weed wasn't very good. This is not going to happen this time. So it will be a way faster ramp up period than we saw with medical, which was like very, very slow.
Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting in your article, which everyone should go read, from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. You described the process as similar to winemaking. And I thought, oh, well, there's something I can like, you know, understand. It was really good. I enjoyed that. Thank you so much for explaining the process.
Well, thank you.
I have been speaking with Laura Hancock, Columbus Bureau reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Thank you again. And coming up, Kentuckians went to the polls this week. We will recap the primary election and find out who the Liberty Republicans are in Kentucky politics. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Tana Weingartner, filling in for Lucy May. This past Tuesday was Election Day in the Bluegrass State. There were some interesting primaries for statewide and federal seats. And while there wasn't a lot happening local, there were a few races that folks were watching really closely. Among them is our next guest, McKenna Horsley. She covers state politics for the Kentucky Lantern. Thank you so much for being on the show, McKenna.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Give us a recap. What were the big headlines Commonwealth-wide from Tuesday night?
Right. So here in Kentucky, our statewide elections are held in off years, away from presidential years. So all of our statewide races were last year. But this year, we're focusing on some of our congressional races, people who will be going to Washington to represent Kentucky, as well as who has control over the General Assembly in Frankfort. In the House, all 100 seats are up for grabs. So all of those incumbents and a few candidates who are challenging them are seeking election to the House. And then we have about a third of Senate seats that are on the ballot this year as well. So in Kentucky, in both the House and Senate, Republicans have a supermajority. And heading into Tuesday, that was kind of likely expected to continue, as well as when we head toward our general election in the fall. And kind of as we have more Republican voters, we've had an increase in Republican voters over the past year or so over Democrats. And also as Republicans gain this hold on Frankfort, we're seeing primary elections become more increasingly important across the state. There were a few incumbents who are not going to face a general challenger. So their races were decided in this primary. With that being said, statewide turnout for Kentucky in this past election was about 12%, almost 13%. But that's kind of on par of what we're seeing with primary elections. Last year in 2023, we had 14.5% turnout. And that did also have a highly contested Republican gubernatorial primary last year. We had about 12 candidates on the ballot. Comparing that to November, Republican Secretary of State Michael Adams said in an interview with me that he's looking for the presidential race to really bring out voter turnout this fall. He's kind of thinking it might be higher, close to 60% turnout. So he's looking for election plans with local county clerks and things like that, making sure we have more polling places available, more poll workers to manage these places, to avoid long lines that might be expected in November. Mm-hmm. Also, early voting is something that's really important to him as well, to avoid those lines in November, too.
All right. And I guess this is where we give the shout out to all the local elections officials who would really love for folks, if you're able to volunteer to learn how to become poll workers, they need you and they are ready and willing to take you on and teach you how to do it.
On that note, in Kentucky, poll workers are paid. So it varies county to county. But if you have the day off and are interested in making some money, reach out to your local county clerk and see how you can go about that.
Okay. Now, the big phrase that we kept hearing and all as I was preparing for this and reading up is Liberty Republicans. McKenna, yes. I have no idea. What is a Liberty Republican? Who are they? What's their story?
Yeah, so in Kentucky, the Liberty Republican movement, I would say it's kind of akin to nationally what we saw with Tea Party Republicans a few years ago. They kind of define themselves by adhering to the state constitution, the U.S. Constitution, and the Republican platform. So kind of what we've seen here in the General Assembly is that these Republican these Liberty Republicans have kind of a terse relationship, I would say, with GOP leadership in the House. Like I've said, Republicans hold these super majorities in both the House and Senate, but that is kind of molding as we see as this power grows with different, some people want to say factions or different groups within the supermajority itself. The Liberty Republican movement is centered around Northern Kentucky. But in this past primary, we did see that grow a bit across the state. So two Republican incumbents who are kind of more of the establishment type, Representative Killian Timoney of Nicholasville, that's in central Kentucky, and then Representative Richard Heath of Mayfield out in West Kentucky. They both lost to Liberty challengers. And Timoney, he's kind of more of a moderate, that type that we've seen. He did vote against a proposed constitutional amendment that's been dubbed the School Choice Amendment, that would allow the General Assembly to fund non-public schools. That's something that Kentucky voters will be deciding this year. He's also had a vote that was using this campaign against him a bit, against an anti-transgender law. But he has come out since Tuesday saying that he doesn't regret those votes and that sort of thing. And then Richard Heath would be known to Republican voters across the state because he did run for agriculture commissioner last year, but lost in the primary to now agriculture commissioner Jonathan Schell. And Heath did have a chairman's position within the caucus. He is the chairman of the agriculture committee within the House. So that's kind of a spot that will be up for grabs next year with him as well.
Okay. Are all, like, is everyone who's a Liberty Republican, are they all united behind a particular set of ideas, or are they kind of all over the place?
Well, it's kind of a loose term, right? Like, you know, they're like, if you go on the Legislative Research Commission's website and you look at the caucuses that a member is, that a lawmaker is a part of, you know, you won't find the Liberty Caucus. Like, it's not a formal thing like that. But you can go to KentuckyLibertyCaucus.com and you can see a list of candidates that that caucus endorses, as well as putting money behind in some of these races. And it kind of depends on who you ask politically, who's a member of this caucus, right? So, you know, one thing I think that's really defined some of these incumbent members was a rules challenge that happened earlier this year, led by Representative Felicia Rayburn, who did win her primary this week as well. She and some other Republicans like Savannah Maddox in Northern Kentucky, they backed a change that would kind of loosen the hold that Republican leadership has on the rules of a House. That ultimately did fail, but it's kind of these challenges toward leadership that unites them.
Okay. I want to come back to Savannah Maddox in just a minute, but first, how do Liberty Republicans view Donald Trump? You know, are they lining up? Do they want his backing, or are they in a different camp here?
You know, I was reading earlier today, kind of back to the Liberty Kentucky Caucus website. You know, they do view Donald Trump as an influence. And I think a lot of these lawmakers that I've mentioned, you know, are supportive of Donald Trump. The Kentucky Republican Party as a whole, their statewide convention was this past weekend, and they selected their electorate. And you know, here in Kentucky, it's likely that Donald Trump will win our electoral votes. He did in 2016 and 2020. He did receive a higher percentage compared to Democratic voters of Republican support compared to Joe Biden. But with that to say, you know, I don't know if Donald Trump is a 100% factor, right? Because a lot of these Liberty Republicans were at Representative Congressman Massey's, Thomas Massey's victory party this week as well. And Donald Trump did not endorse Massey in his race. And while I don't think Congressman Massey holds ill will towards that, that's kind of a political note as well.
All right. Let's get back to Representative Savannah Maddox. She's one of our local folks here. She's out of Dry Ridge. We do have a quick bit of sound from her.
Just because a candidate says that they're conservative doesn't mean that their actual belief system, or in many instances, their voting record reflects that. Kentucky's voters are increasingly paying attention and they are reading between the lines. And I think that it sent a resounding message last night that it's not going to be business as usual in Frankfort. And that is something that I've been working for many years.
All right. Tell us about how the Liberty Republicans, folks like Savannah Maddox, especially all of our representatives from the Northern Kentucky area did on Tuesday night.
Yeah. So Savannah Maddox did really well in her reelection campaign. She won over an opponent by 66 points.
Wow.
And yeah, it was a pretty high margin. I think one of the highest across the state. We are seeing a few incumbents in that area as well that are doing well. Like Rayburn did win her primary. And she's not completely Northern Kentucky, but she's up there. Steve Doan, I think, also did well this past week. And so another race to watch in that area, it was for an open seat for Representative Steve Rawlings of Burlington. Mm-hmm. He is running for the Senate, and he did win his primary after Union Senator John Schickel announced his retirement. For Rawlings' seat, we did see T.J. Roberts win, and he is another Liberty-aligned candidate.
All right. Okay. And I guess getting back to sort of Massey and Roberts, I understand Massey has accused Roberts of having a lack of support for Donald Trump. Is that going to help or hurt him, do you think?
I don't know. You know, I mean, Roberts has been definitely aligned with this liberty movement even before he began to run for office. We did speak a bit this week after his win, and he became involved with politics at a very young age. He's now 26, and he would be the first Gen Z Republican if he wins election against his Democratic opponent this year. But he became involved with politics very on early and has had a chance to really work with these Liberty Republicans on their campaigns and support them kind of behind the scenes as a on their campaigns as well. So I think he's definitely getting the support from incumbents in the legislature.
Okay. Kind of looking forward, is this caucus growing? I mean, I know they don't have a formal caucus, but, you know, how influential is this bloc, and are their numbers growing, or what's the status?
Yeah, you know, I did mention those two incumbents, that the more establishment type versus the liberty is kind of how the terms are aligning. But we did see two liberty candidates primary to establishment incumbents. So Killian Timoney was that, and then Richard Heath was the other one. And so we're kind of seeing a bit of a growth in this movement. And I think that that's something that Liberty Republicans like Roberts and Maddox, from their interviews that I've talked with this week, are looking forward to. You know, they're a minority within the supermajority, but I think if they keep getting their message across, they keep recruiting candidates to their cause, we might see this gain more traction in the next few election cycles.
All right. We will be watching, especially coming up in November. I've been chatting with McKenna Horsley, politics reporter for the Kentucky Lantern. Thanks for getting us up to speed, McKenna.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Up next, new leadership at Cincinnati Public Schools, and there are about to be construction rumbles in the jungle. Paycor Stadium, that is, of course. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Tiana Weingartner, filling in for Lucy May. It feels like it wouldn't be a reporter roundup lately without an update from our own WVXU education reporter, Zach Carrion, on what's been going on with the shakeup in leadership at Cincinnati Public Schools. Thanks for getting up early this morning to host Morning Edition and for sticking around to talk with us, Zach.
Anytime, Tana.
All right. Last time you were here, you were talking about Cincinnati Superintendent Ironetta Wright's resignation. Now we have some details about who's going to fill her shoes. Fill us in.
Yeah, it's certainly been a roller coaster few weeks at CPS. Like you said, Superintendent Ironetta Wright resigned only just last Wednesday. And as of Monday, we do have a new interim superintendent and deputy superintendent. So they decided to go internally. They went with some experienced principals and administrators within the district. One of them, Shauna Murphy, who will serve as the interim. And Elisa Smith, who will serve as deputy interim. And they've been in the school district for quite some time. Shauna Murphy specifically, she has 34 years in education. 25 of those are within CPS. She's been a principal of Hyde Park Elementary, Quebec Heights Elementary School, which is now closed. That just shows how long she's been there, and was the principal of Woodward High School as well. Elisa Smith, as well, 30 years of experience in education, and was the principal of Rothenburg Prep Academy as well. So that's who they decided to go with, two Cincinnati natives. And, you know, this is what the school board was in favor of. But, of course, not everybody was excited about it.
All right. Well, first, before we get to that, we do have a bit of sound from interim superintendent Elisa Smith.
Over 20 years, we're here as teachers, principals, assistant principals, coaches. I mean, we've done the work. We've been a part of CPS. We are CPS. We know the principals. We know teachers. We know families. We live in the community. So, yes, we know. We've been around a long time.
Okay. So she's saying basically what you did. They've been here a long time. We know these people were from here. But as you were hinting at, before I rudely cut you off, not everybody was like a favor? Well, what kind of happened here?
Yeah, well, I do think that is also, you know, important, because one of the things with Superintendent Ironetta Wright was she was an outsider. She came from Florida. She was in one of the school systems down there, and also in Detroit as well. So she came from two really big school systems. Of course, CPS is big as well, but not quite that big. So one of the things that ultimately did push her out was the fact that she was an outsider. She did things in a different way. So I think it says something that Shauna Murphy and Elisa Smith were selected internally and have live here and have been here a really long time. I think that's very relevant. However, like you said, there is some opposition to this. Ben Lindy, who is certainly the biggest supporter on the board of former Superintendent Ironetta Wright, he said that, you know, he felt that his other board members had rushed to this decision. He was against getting rid of Wright in the first place, and also against bringing in two new interim superintendents to take her place. He said that, you know, this whole entire process was only 6 days, and they had only spoken to each of the candidates being Murphy and Smith, for 10 minutes. And there really wasn't much of a interview process besides that. So that was one of the biggest things that he had. You know, he really has been sharing his disapproval of what the school board has been doing in recent weeks, and it's caused a little bit of a divide there. Now, Kendra Mapp, one of the newest member of the school board, was on his side as well and shared some similar thoughts too. But everybody else on the school board was in favor of this. It seemed like they thought that this was a step in the right direction.
Okay, and I just want to clarify something. I misspoke when I was introducing Elisa Smith in her soundbite there. She is deputy interim superintendent. Apologies for that. Thank you so much for getting us back on board. All right. So it's kind of like a really crazy time for the district to be without a permanent leader, especially like in terms of the budget. Can you sort of explain what's going on?
It's absolutely a crazy time. So we've talked about several times on this show when Lucy May was here that they are in the middle of setting their budget for next year, and they're doing it without millions of dollars of COVID relief funding that they received, you know, in 2020, 2021, 2022. So in order to do that, they're making all these cuts to kind of reach that balanced budget. Now, they ran into some problems with Ironetta Wright. They weren't really getting a whole lot of suggestions that the school board was in favor of to kind of close that gap. And there was also some accounting issues. So, you know, just a month ago, they were at about $6 million. That's what they thought the budget gap left to close was. So they thought, you know, we can do this without firing any teachers, without merging any schools. Now there was a double accounting error, and you know, those things do happen sometimes. And, you know, that went from $13 million. And then on Monday, it was revealed that now they're sitting at $26 million to close. And they are aiming to make that, to close that gap by June 30th. It is a short deadline. So having two new interim superintendents kind of doing this together, it's going to be tough. Jennifer Wagner, the treasurer, said this next month or so, it's going to be grueling.
And what, if anything, have Murphy and Smith said about the financial situation or maybe their plans for that?
Yeah, so they said they're going to get to it right away. So when we spoke to them on Monday night, they had a meeting scheduled for Tuesday morning with all of the union leaders of the various unions within CPS. They're going to go line by line through this budget. What do we need to cut? What do we want to hang on to? Now, this is going to be a multiple week process, so we don't really know what they're going to come up with quite yet. We'll have a better idea on their next school board meeting, June 3rd, but they said it's going to be a challenge. You know, $26 million is a lot to cut in a month,
yeah.
And that's going to mean probably cutting some personnel. They call that RIF, reduction in force. So that's definitely going to be on the table. I think almost everything is going to be on the table. The school board in recent weeks had voted against increasing the walk radius for students, which, you know, cuts a number of students out of eligibility to receive yellow bus transportation. So I think everything's going to be on the table. A few months ago, the Superintendent Ironetta Wright and the administration had brought up the possibility of merging some schools. That was done away with after some pushback. But, you know, at this point, it could also be up there as well.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, so much for a nice, easy summer break. What about, let's go back to finding a permanent superintendent. What's sort of the plan, the timeline for that?
So they're aiming for the end of this coming school year, 2024-2025. So that gives them about a year to find a permanent superintendent. So Murphy and Smith will hold this position for probably sometime about a year. And we asked them, are you both interested in this position? And both of them said yes. So we can expect both of them to put their hat in the ring when that time comes.
All right. Very good. Thank you so much for that update, Zach.
No problem.
All right. And now it's time for sports. I can't believe I'm finally hosting Cincinnati Edition. We get to talk about football, but of course not European football, which everyone knows that's kind of my jam. We are going to talk about American football, specifically the Cincinnati Bengals, and even more specifically, where they play, Paycor Stadium. Joining me to hopefully not fumble through the details is Steve Watkins, staff reporter with the Cincinnati Business Courier. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, Tana. Thanks for having me, and great pun.
Thank you. Thank you. That's my homage to Jay Hanselman. All right. Tell us about what the team announced this week that it plans to do at Paycor Stadium.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal. The Bengals said they are going to invest between $100 million and $120 million in what they call major improvements to Paycor Stadium. And these are going to be things that are going to be visible to the fans, as opposed to things like locker rooms and player facilities. These are fan amenities. It's going to be things like updating video and audio systems, renovating suites and club lounges, concession upgrades, beautification around the stadium. There's a lot that's going to be noticed by the fans. It will take a little while. They expect construction to run through 2026. So it could be a couple of years before most of this is noticed.
Okay. And how much of this is going to be funded by the Bengals? How much is Bengals money? And how much is county taxpayer money?
Yeah, that's always a good question with these things. So in this round, the Bengals are paying that amount. And as they said, it's $100 million to $120 million. The Bengals pointed out that makes $150 million over the last few years, roughly, that they've invested in the stadium. Because a couple of years ago, they built the indoor practice facility, IEL facility, right next to Paycor Stadium, and made some other changes, concession upgrades and ribbon boards and things like that. And that was about $40 million. Now, this year, these renovations can be a little hard to keep track of,
yeah.
And especially paying for them. This year, there is a project going on in the offseason now, and the county is paying for that. That's about $39 million. And that involves things like resurfacing the field, renovating locker rooms, updating club seats, that sort of thing. They're expanding a plaza outside one of the gates as well. So there is some give and take on who's paying for what.
Mm-hmm. And who's paying for those other ones, those previously announced ones, and when are those going to be done, finished?
Yeah, well, the ones this offseason are being paid for by Hamilton County. Those should be done in time for the season, which the first preseason game will be in August. The ones from a couple of years ago, the Bengals paid for. So it's almost like they're taking turns here. And of course, this is all part of or leading up to a bigger negotiation for massive renovations that could total at least $500 million. And a recent estimate, actually recent being in the past year, had it at more like $600 to $850 million. So we're looking at a lot of money. These are parts of it, but admittedly, they're small pieces.
Oh, my God. Okay, so that's a lot. Like, who would be paying for that?
Well, that's all being negotiated. A year, we had a story my colleague Chris Wetterich wrote a couple of weeks ago. A year ago, the Bengals offered a 5-year lease extension. The lease expires before the 2026 season, so that's coming up. The Bengals offered $350 million in improvements to the stadium. $300 million of which would be paid for by the county, and the Bengals would kick in $50 million. The county said, no, that's not going to work for us, and they are still negotiating and probably will be right up until they need to be. Now, the Bengals can extend their current lease in 2-year increments, a number of times. I think it's 5 times, and I think it's 2 years each. So they could just keep up with the current lease if they need to, but both sides would like a longer commitment.
Mm-hmm. What should be, you know, should we read anything into this investment that the Bengals just announced this week in terms of as they're looking toward negotiating?
Right. That's a good question. It seems like it is a good sign. And the county actually sent me a statement when I wrote the story from Jeff Aluto, the county administrator, who indicated that he sees it as what he called, in quote, a significant step, unquote, in achieving what the county wants, which is, they call it a multifaceted funding mechanism, meaning the county isn't just going to pay all or virtually all of it. And so the county obviously wants the Bengals and the NFL to kick in some money. And Jeff Aluto and the county see this as a significant step toward that. $100 million to $120 million is a pretty significant amount.
Okay, so what's the likelihood? I mean, does the NFL just do that? I don't really know how this works. Are they likely to give us money?
Well, most people don't. It's kind of often behind the scenes, but it's coming up a little more lately, more publicly. The NFL does kick in, and this is one of the sticking points. The NFL has kicked in or has committed to on some new stadium constructions in Buffalo and Nashville. Now, this is a renovation. So Alicia Reese, the county commissioner, said recently she expects the NFL to invest at least $100 million in this renovation. Now, will the NFL do that? We don't know. They typically have invested more in new stadiums, but some of these renovations are running into costs that are not that much less than a new stadium. Hmm. And so it makes sense that the county would definitely want the NFL to invest in these projects. And it makes sense for the NFL and the Bengals too, because they can help and then the Bengals can put in some money and it kind of offsets the load on the county, which is not going to have the kind of money that that the Bengals might want them to invest in the next stadium renovations.
All right. In like 40 seconds, Steve, what are you going to be watching for next?
Well, the next thing will probably be what happens with these negotiations. There is the 2026, and that's more like summer of 2026, so 2 years away, deadline. So the Bengals and the county will no doubt be going back and forth with dollar amounts, and hopefully they will come up with a long-term solution. If not, we're probably likely to see at least a short-term extension.
Very good. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thanks, Tana.
Steve Watkins is staff reporter with the Cincinnati Business Courier. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Tana Weingartner. Lucy May returns next week. Thank you so much for listening. And please tell your pets I said hello.